Hi, this is Adam Feinberg, and I'm here again with Mark Becker joining us.
How's it going, everyone?
All right. Hopefully our audience feels the same, too. Welcome to Harlem Stories. Today, we're going to discuss something that has an explosive nature to it. And we're going to talk about Columbia University, and they had two topics that are kind of at least at some point interrelated, but we're going to talk about Columbia's forgotten nuclear testing lab. And of course, that couldn't have happened without the Manhattan Project. And then there's been an offshoot and a recent update, in terms of some of that as well. So today we're going to discuss over here that many New Yorkers know that Columbia University is one of the largest private landowners in the city, along with, of course, NYU. They both own roughly very close to the same amount of space, about 14 million square feet of office and classroom space and other, usable space. However, with NYU kind of much more spread out, Columbia owns a rather large portion of the land in Morningside Heights and now owns a large portion of Manhattanville. And, Manhattanville, we had a whole separate episode on that. It plays a big part in the story. And, there's a building that's been part of Columbia for a very, very long time called Prentice Hall. And Prentice Hall is part of that new campus, even though it's an existing building. Prentice Hall is located on 125th Street, and Mark, I know we were discussing in past episodes, there was the McDonald's drive-thru over there, then there were a bunch of small, little warehouse buildings that have since been torn down, and then there's this very, very large, grand building next to that, and that is Prentice Hall. Prentice Hall has been reused more recently. One of our hosts had actually taken a class there, within the acting world, and, and that was Robert. He had taken classes there, and he said, or at least, spent some time there with the acting teams over there that are teaching in that building. It was originally constructed, that Prentice Hall, which was originally called the Sheffield Farms Pasteurization Facility and Milk Bottling Plant. Now, what's interesting is the vast majority in New York of milk in New York City went through these bottling plants in Manhattanville. With a large portion specific to this building.
What years were the?
It was constructed in 1909. The building, and it was in these early 1909 to let's say the early 30s or so that it was being used as a milk bottling facility. And, this whole area over here relied on a freight railroad and ferries along the Hudson. And you can actually still see, and Columbia was trying to preserve this as well, with their new campus expansion, evidence of the old freight railroad tracks that they preserved, ultimately. So there was so much activity going on there. There was Sheffield Farms, there was Borden Dairy, and there was a firm called McDermott Bunger. And between those three bottling companies, they controlled 61% of the dairy business in New York City. So all within a few blocks of each other, and they controlled 61% of dairy in the city. So, pretty powerful over there. And as a result, they built the building to accommodate their highly specialized needs back then. The first floor accommodated horse-drawn wagons, because remember, this was 1909, and ironically, that area of Manhattanville also included, and I'm sure we'll probably discuss this in further detail at a later point, but there were two automotive plants in the area as well. One of them, I believe, was actually part of that Borden facilities. But at some point, that garage door that I was talking about with the horse-drawn wagons, it's still in place along with the cobblestones in the interior driveway. So if you ever walk past there and are lucky enough to see, those doors open, you can actually see the interior cobblestones in that area. That original horse stable for Sheffield is now the location of Hudson and Moving and Storage. It's just one of three properties in the Columbia campus expansion zone that Columbia did not acquire. And, you know, they were in talk about moving that entire building a few blocks along 125th Street next to where Columbia is now building that residential building. But unfortunately, it seems like that residential building may take up that entire space. So that building along Broadway, you know, I think it's around 130th or so, that is no longer in play. But I know that was, you know, certainly being discussed, and they were trying to get state funds from the state in order to do this, and they are currently filing to make that building a landmark. Columbia owns land where and ultimately they wound up building this new tower on that space. So it was, you know, partially up to Columbia what they were planning on doing, but they haven't announced, you know, some of these plans publicly besides the tower. So a lot of speculation as to some where that was going. But as the horse-drawn wagons became obsolete, so did these plants and some of the stables that we were discussing. And it created an opportunity for Columbia to buy the plant in 1949, so it was actually a little later than I originally thought, as part of its planned engineering school. And ultimately, they felt like this space was easily adaptable for an engineering lab, which required steam, water, refrigeration, and drainage. And what's interesting about it is the floors in some places are more than a foot and a half, 2 foot tall, and over-engineered for the horses, the carriages, and the filled milk bottles. But since we mentioned that, you know, in order for this to become an engineering lab, you need access to a water supply. Well, interestingly enough, that the building has a running freshwater stream below it, and the lab could pipe water directly up from the wells to cool down and cool down some of the testing processes that they were involved in. And the stream occasionally still, it's still there, you know, like so many underground streams in Manhattan. I want to say it's maybe 1 Fifth Avenue or 2 Fifth Avenue where they still have a marker in the lobby, you know, for the stream all the way down by Washington Square Park. Mm. So if you go down to like one of those buildings, I'm sure the doorman will probably tell you, you know, where to look, and you know, the public can go and view that, but you can see the marker where the underground streams sometimes rise up to. And they have like an underground marker, you know, marked over there and a little public space where, you know, people can take a look. So a lot of old New York history. There's plenty of old underground streams that have been rerouted over the years. But in some cases, that stream below does cause backups, and occasionally it does need to be drained. During a drought in the 1970s, trucks came to Prentice Hall to pump water to distribute to the rest of the campus. And even today, you can still hear running water in the basement. So, you know, they were originally thinking, or at least Columbia was originally thinking, about the running water, the steam that it could produce, and the electricity that was going to be required for some of their experiments. So unfortunately, at some point, the plant required so much electricity that it would slow the subway for 15 seconds while the motor was started, and the demand was so significant, it was the single largest customer of Con Ed in the city at times, or just trailing the World Trade Center. And when I say World Trade Center, I'm talking the original 1970s Trade Center that was attacked. So Prentice Hall was just one of three early buildings in the new campus expansion zone that Columbia will preserve. The others, and I had mentioned this before, that there were a couple of automobile production plants. There was the Studebaker automobile production plant, and as I was saying earlier, I was correct. It was the Borden plant prior. And there's also the Warren Nash building, a former car servicing plant. So they weren't just automotive production, they were also repair as well. I know there's pictures out there, filmed and video out there, early video filmed out there by Thomas Edison himself. So I know that film out there actually exists. I've seen it only runs a few seconds, but I've actually seen that. While all this background is interesting, it's probably not the reason why you're tuning into today's episode. You know, I started talking about some really sexy
stuff. They're tuning
in
to hear your silky smooth voice, Adam.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I was meant to be a radio host, but not really. But in any case, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's not the real reason, but I think some of the background history was important to understand why, you know, why ultimately it became a nuclear testing lab facility. So now we get into the spicy stuff. Prentice Hall was operational, and Columbia, you know, along with its purchase over here, in 1953, it functioned as the School of Engineering and Applied Science. The dean is kind of relevant in this situation, John R. Dunning, and he was a key member of the Manhattan Project. And we'll get more into the Manhattan Project later on. Mm-hmm. And yesterday's update on a spinoff of that, which was the Doomsday Clock. Dunning, he was a scientist. He actually built the cyclotron, which was the particle accelerator, needed as part of the Manhattan Project. And he built it in the basement of Pupin Hall at Columbia. And that's the device that first split the uranium atom in the U.S. in 1939. The cyclotron itself was decommissioned in 1965. And it's worth also mentioning that Pupin Hall was also where FM radio was created.
Wow.
So, you know, all this great real history all resides within, you know, Columbia, within Manhattanville, within Morningside Heights. And I know, you know, tying back to an episode that you and I recorded recently, which was the Battle of Harlem Heights. And we'd even talked George Washington. So all this ties all into each other on the extreme amounts of interesting history that ties back to these neighborhoods.
Well, I'll tell you, thank God for FM radio. You ever tried to listen to AM? It's nothing but Spanish music and maybe an occasional orchestra, you know, some Beethoven. I can't listen to rock and roll on AM, so I'm glad they founded FM radio.
Listen, I'm a rock and roll guy, but every once in a while I do enjoy some classical, and, you know, Spanish music is not my choice, but hey, you know, it's going to be somebody else's, so,
sure.
You know, we don't want to downplay AM either, but yeah, I prefer FM.
No, I don't mean to hate on AM.
All right, well, you know, it just gives you an idea of that, but the cyclotron, and, you know, this is really, you know, interesting. It was supposedly, it was in the basement of Pupin Hall, and it was supposedly scrapped in 2007, and it was stored in the tunnels that connect many of Columbia's buildings. I don't know if you knew that many of Columbia's main campus buildings are interconnected in the basements over there. And that was an aspect, and we'll probably have an entire episode on the Columbia campus buildings and the history of the asylum that was there predating Columbia University's home there. But it predated the campus, and some of those was, you know, when the land contained the insane asylum. These tunnels, they were used for many different reasons over the years, often students to avoid, you know, above ground traffic. That was supposedly the legitimate purposes for it. But while the university was engaged with the Manhattan Project, the tunnels were allegedly used to move radioactive material between the buildings. And apparently in 1987, a student was expelled after stealing uranium-238, chloroform, mercury, and pure caffeine from Pupin Hall using those tunnels.
Wow.
Some of the tunnels have since been sealed off by the university, while others are still in use. And there's enough material here to discuss the tunnels beneath Columbia and Barnard in a whole separate episode. But, you know, needless to say, you know, these tunnels have seen their use over the years, you know, some for nefarious reasons. And
I wonder if there's a tunnel connecting Barnard to Columbia.
You know what? I don't know, but that would have to be a little bit more complicated, because if you think about it, also the one train runs right under between those, right between the two.
It would help for a campus romance, wouldn't it?
Yeah, oh, I'm sure, and I'm sure that those tunnels have been used for that as well. so in any case, the you know, Columbia had this heat transfer research facility, and it predated, you know, which was at, you know, at the Prentice Hall, and it predated any national labs, and it's been responsible for generations of nuclear reactor fuel assemblies. So the lab would basically, they'd test the sample of rods for nuclear reactors to demonstrate how the fuel bundle would work safely in operation. And so that gives you kind of that sense over there. So these tests were used to determine at which point a reactor might burn out and cause a Chernobyl-style meltdown. So kind of scary to think that, like, in Manhattan that this nuclear lab testing is happening, but obviously they're using all the right protocols and information. They're testing in the right kind of facility, even though it's in a highly you know, public area, you know, just New York City as a whole having that many people. But the lab first operated under Atoms for Peace program started by President Eisenhower in the 1950s. Most of the testing done in this research facility were for industrial project, more like civilian nuclear power companies, Westinghouse. But the lab also supported U.S. government U.S. government testing for nuclear subs in the Navy and other government reactors. They've since closed the testing facility since 2004, and it's now home to the School of the Arts and the Music Department at Columbia. And even though it was ultimately shut down because it wasn't the most economical, it was still profitable for a very long time. And ultimately, Columbia determined the space would be better used by other programs within the university since it was so space constrained. And most of the areas that were being used in the nuclear testing lab facility component, they've been closed off, they've been locked up, and haven't been repurposed in all these years. Now, the other aspect that's worth mentioning, and this was just in the news yesterday, so again, we want to kind of keep our listeners, you know, up to date on timely aspects. I'm sure most people have heard of the Doomsday Clock Project. It was previously at 100 minutes to midnight, midnight representing the end of humanity. So kind of a dark topic there. But the Doomsday Project was actually created as an offshoot as a result of the creation of nuclear weapons. And ultimately, it was, you know, some of the same scientists that were part of the Manhattan Project. It just got updated from 100 minutes to midnight down to 90 minutes to midnight. But, you know, being that we're talking about nuclear...
What's the justification for that?
Justification is actually really simple on it. Without getting into all fine details, there were a few main core reasons. And, you know, once I say it, you're going to say, oh, my God, that was so obvious. But number one is, you know, the, you know, Russia-Ukraine war and the potential for use of nuclear weapons in World War III. And while that may never happen, at the same point, you know, the Doomsday Clock is meant to represent risks, and that's certainly a risk. Climate change, certainly as well. We've been seeing that. Not every government is taking that as seriously as they should or investing the way that they should to account for it. And finally, the third major reason in that was it wasn't necessarily just COVID on its own, but the reactions from the public and the governments, you know, on how we should handle public health crises and, you know, biological threats, you looking forward. And, you know, being that there has been so much disinformation out there, you know, they're considering that to be a risk going forward.
I'm going to create my own clock.
Really? What's your clock going to be tracking?
Well, I don't think we're anywhere near the end of the world. I think we've got a long time to go. So I don't know.
I like the REM version. It's the end of the world, as I know it, and I feel fine. I'm sorry, you were saying?
Well, I just don't know if we're... there have been so many points in history where people have said the world's coming to an end, and it hasn't yet. But I'm only 47, so we'll see what happens in the next 47 years.
Yeah, I think we're going to have our challenges. Hopefully, I'm of the opinion that, you know, I'd love to see science really, you know, take a larger role in solving some of our problems. It certainly sounds very, very promising on the medical end of the spectrum, you know, and you know, we're seeing cures or reactions. I mean, just look how fast we found a vaccine for COVID in under a year. You know, and, you know, it might not have been perfect, but at the same time, it works pretty well overall in the grand scheme of things. So, you know, the technology that was used to find that, I think, is really promising. But at the same time, I don't want to vary too far from our topics, but, you know, these are just these two guys' opinions. And, you know, we'll leave it at that. But Columbia has had this long-standing history in terms of research. I'm hoping that Columbia will be a part of that bigger picture and the research that they do, along with City College as well. And, you know, hopefully there's really some bright things ahead for us.
Hear, hear.
All right. Well, thank you for tuning in. And I know this was one of the sexier topics where we're talking about anything nuclear that related to Columbia and Morningside and West Harlem as a whole and Manhattanville. So, yeah, I'm always happy to talk about that.
You're the bomb.
Oh, ouch. All right. Well, that's a great way to end. But thank you for tuning in to Harlem Stories. And, you know, stay tuned for additional episodes.
Thanks, everyone.